RV Carmel by the Sea with Eric Clapton and Derek and the Dominoes.
It's time now for World Watchers International with Nate Brussel, who for over 17 years has investigated and exposed political conspiracies worldwide. World Watchers International originates at KLRB, Carmel, California. Here's Nate.
For those of you that take the regular tapes by subscription or it's played on other stations, the program will begin in about 10 seconds. There was a time lapse here because Michael, who does the arrangements in KLRB, wasn't there tonight, and another person was at the station, so the switchboard wasn't working as it should. So I'll sign off now, and the regular tape will begin in about 1 second. Well, we'll see.
I gotcha.
You got me?
Yeah.
We're on the air, right? A little trouble in the control room this evening. Michael isn't here, so we'll continue at this point. Are we okay?
Yeah, we're okay.
We're okay. I'll start over. It's tape number 458, in case you didn't get it. On the air, it's September 14th, 1980. Sorry for the mix-up here. Michael's in San Jose on Sunday evening. I'm used to him handling the switchboard, but we'll get off okay. I apologize. I didn't get to the meeting of Amnesty International last week. I announced that there was a meeting here at Monterey Peninsula College on Tuesday evening, and for reasons that I will explain to you next week, I'm not at liberty to explain right now. I couldn't get to the meeting. I wanted to, and many people went. I'm interested in the organization, and if there is a chapter on the peninsula, I will attend. I'm usually not tied up in the evenings if I say I'll be there, but circumstances came up that I couldn't make it. I did want to mention one problem that I had coming back from Los Angeles a week and a half ago. I wasn't going to mention it on the air, but I did make two tape cassettes about a year ago that subscribers got on different incidences that had happened to our family. I'm always asked the question on the telephone, on radio stations, are you in danger, or do you think the kind of work you're doing is dangerous? That comes up very often, so I did 2 hours of various things that had happened to me and my family a while back. But last week, a week ago, 2 weeks ago, I was in Los Angeles, and it was a warm summer evening, and I was in the home with the windows wide open. About 3 in the morning, a car pulled up, and I jumped up, and I heard somebody run down the driveway. The bedroom that I had was in the front of the house. There's a long driveway in the back. My car was parked in the back in the driveway, and I heard someone run down the driveway, and I didn't think it was neighbors. The neighbors didn't come in their car, and I heard them run back and get into the car. And I should have gone downstairs as fast as I could to see what was going on, but I don't like to be paranoid, and I thought, I don't know what I thought, but that's what I heard. So that day, next morning, we were leaving to drive back up to Carmel, and I made up my mind I would go very slow and not that 60 or 70 plus miles an hour. I like to tear up Highway 101. Coming home, and was going very slowly, and outside of San Luis Obispo, about 45 miles, there was a flare on the road, and a trailer turned over, and we had forced to go slow and almost to stop, and then just crawl along. The cars were crawling, and we smelled this burning, and we thought the flares smelled because the windows were open. And when the cars picked up speed and the trailer situation was cleared up, instead of escalating, I pulled to the side of the road, and by then my car was smoking and we were through the hood, and it was very bad condition. And I turned the key and there was no engine. And we had to be towed into San Luis Obispo about 40 miles and stay there overnight. And the next morning it was in the shop, and the water hose evidently had been cut, the line of water to the engine. I didn't get to the engine, and the engine completely burned out, and I had to get another car, bought a used car, and came on home. I didn't really rent a car, whatever. I mean, the mechanics of replacing the burned-out car aren't important. The point was that I should have jumped up to try to see what was happening, and the people at the car agency explained that it was burned, and when I came home, I went to the garage to take care of the car ever since I got it. And to one other agency described the situation, they thought it would be almost impossible unless the water hose was cut in some way, and it didn't register on the dashboard. I just mentioned that in case anything comes up in the future. You add these things, they're cumulative, and I don't know. We'll never know what happened, but if I'd been going very fast, the speed I usually go, it might have been pretty dangerous. But as a safety, as a precaution, or whatever, I feel better sharing these with you, these instances, as they happen, because sometimes they come in bunches, and then the pressure's off for a while before something else comes up. Now to the news. I'm going to digress from Ronald Reagan and get back to Ronald Reagan, but as a sideline of Reagan to make a transition to Jimmy Carter, I want to go into a very complicated subject that in 50, 55 minutes, it's difficult to describe to people who haven't thought of it in these terms, and this is the situation of narcotic war that is going on at this time. We hear a lot of the candidates talking about their political opinions, what they would do with the military, what they would do with the economy, and so forth, but there's very little said about the organizations that they belong to that are directly linked to organized crime and how the turf is being divided between them and how the battle between the major candidates, the Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan team that never really lost power, the strong California, Florida, the Marseille connections, the Vietnam, the Golden Triangle, the, down there, not the Afghanistan, Turkey, Middle East arch of narcotics. The Southeast Asia narcotic combat increased with the Vietnam War and involvement in Southeast Asia. Involved not only Richard Nixon, his entire career with links to organized crime and mafia, but those people who have also been the strong supporters of Ronald Reagan and his campaign ever since they decided to run him for governor and then for president of the United States. I have quoted several times before an article in U.S. News and World Report. It was published last year in 1979, that mafia-related activities gross a minimum of over $40 billion a year, totally not taxable. All of this money is from organized crime and stays in the hands of criminals that never do see jail. People like Meyer Lansky or Carlos Marcello maybe spend a few months in jail in their entire life, and that is all. They hire hitmen and mob lieutenants. Their salaries range from $75,000 to $165,000 a year. And U.S. News Report describes these crime figures as having more profit than General Motors, Exxon, and Sears Roebuck combined. And that is a lot of profit. But the economists that are on radio stations or send out their newsletters and people watch the Ruff Report or various reports on the economy, what to do with gold, what to do with silver and investments and interest rates, how to get the most for your money, never have articles on the effect, the very serious effect of organized crime on the economy, how it affects housing and retail stores and grocery stores or mom-and-pop stores or franchises, the rates of hotel rooms and resorts, and the prostitution, the effect of blackmail prostitution and forgery of documents and stealing of securities and so forth. This is a business. This is the most lucrative business in the United States. Next to it would come, I suppose, oil and weapons and then the medical industry. But no candidate ever addresses himself to organized crime or to the profits or what it does to our livelihood. So I want to talk about that complicated subject the best I can in this small amount of time. And, of course, in the past and the future, we'll be referring to this as the weeks go on and as I've done before on the other tapes. Just before I get into the subject of organized crime, I do want to mention last week I referred to a book on the suppressed poems of Robinson Jeffers. It's called In This Wild Water, and there are 12 poems that were deleted from one of the books that he published, The Double Axe, that Random House wouldn't publish. But there's one poem of these deleted, and I thought maybe I would read one a week, because I'm ornery, and when they don't want you to see them, I want you to see them. And there's a poem he wrote, Pourvu que ça dure, meaning provided that it lasts. And this poem is a symbol. It is very much in tune with what I feel about my research and the necessity to expose the kinds of things that are going on today and not pretend they don't exist. Robinson Jeffers said, life grows, life is not made. You make death. Neither were the sun nor the stars created, but grew from what grew before. Without the corruption of plants and corpses, life could not grow. Look around you at civilization decaying and sick. He wrote this in 1948 is when it was suppressed. Look at science corrupted to be death's bawd, and art, painting, and sculpture that had some dignity is corrupted in the show-off antics of an imbecile child, and statecraft into the democratic gestures of a gin-muddled butcher boy. Look all around you and praise the solitary hawk flights of God. He liked the hawk going off into the sunset, the symbolism of the bird and his freedom. And you can say, what a stinking of famous corpses to fertilize the fields of the human future. If man's back holds, that's the title of the poem, if man's back holds. And what he tried to say is that the burden of corruption that we have to bear in the future as we live and our life goes on, that we should look around us and see that things are corrupted, whether it's our science, this new DNA scandal, the cloning, or the inability to put radiation or the pay off or spin off from using radioactive material. We don't know what to do with it. And building buildings that have cancer-causing substances in them and ships and so forth. He says science and art and statecraft are made up of famous corpses that are stinking. And yet everything comes from what precedes it. And new forms evolve, and that if you don't acknowledge corruption, then the future will depend on the decaying and sick spin-off of science and so forth. He claimed that we misused science for our wars and for death, and that art is misused and that statecraft is misused. And Robinson Jeffers said, man has to bear the weight of this civilization if he wants to continue to live. He has to acknowledge those things about him and then get back to the relationship of man to his own nature. Charles Spears, who I have mentioned before on other tapes, who collects a chronology of events, was outraged, as I was last week, when NBC on the Today Show had Richard Nixon with a three-part series as if he were an elder statement, dignified, and so forth. And Charles got out September the 8th after he saw that show, a section of his chronology and put it in letter form and sent it to public officials. And a few dates, I'll read you just about 12 dates of the Nixon administration in case you forgot it or don't remember back to 1968. Some of you do. He wrote a letter April the 4th, 1968, Martin Luther King shot and killed June the 4th, 1968, Robert Kennedy killed at the Ambassador Hotel to get Nixon elected. August 1968, the Chicago Democratic riots led by federal agent provocateurs. May the 9th, 1969, the bombing, bombing Vietnam, Nixon and Kissinger start 6 years of bombing Cambodia to keep the B-52 flyboys happy. July 18th, 1969, Chappaquiddick set up by the Defense Department to eliminate the third Kennedy brother. May 1st, 1972, J. Edgar Hoover is deep sixed by the MKU toothbrush trick after Nixon asked him to resign. Deep six means to be put into his grave. The MKU is the chemical or the poison that got J. Edgar Hoover. And a few days later, May 15th, 1972, George Wallace shot for 20% of the conservative votes. November the 7th, 72, Nixon landslides into Congress as a president in his second term, rather. And December the 8th, 1972, Nixon terror regarding United Flight 553. That was the United airplane to get blackmailer Dorothy Hunt, where she and the entire plane load were killed, and her husband was a defendant in the Watergate case. 1973, Nixon and Murray Chotiner pardon and commute 500 crime syndicate people out of prison in one single year. Vice President Agnew resigned in disgrace in August of 73. In November 73, the White House tapes were erased by Rosemary Baby Scores again. That was Richard Nixon's secretary. January 72, a mail truck kills Murray Chotiner in front of Edward Kennedy's house. That Murray Chotiner was the member of organized crime that discovered Nixon and Earl Warren. 1972, Howard Hughes dope double dies. The real Hughes died in 67. And it was actually 1976 when the dope double was turned in, cashed in. July 19, 1972, Nixon's hatchet man, Charles Colson, said, "If this nation is infiltrated the way I think it is, we haven't got a government." The chronology of murders and deaths of Gary Powers with his helicopter running out of gas, the U-2 pilot, the death of Hale Boggs, Lou Staples, the radio man in Dallas, Texas. This list of chronologies is of death and murders, of unsolved stories, the Jonestown scandal, the murder of the 30-day Pope, who was deep sixth, so that the John Paul II could take over, Nelson Rockefeller gets the MKU and deep sixth, so forth, in control for Carter. All these things were going on with the team of Nixon and Ford up till the time and through Jimmy Carter's term. The intelligence group were at work with these deaths and murders of politicians or important people. And when you total up, this is just a few of the names, there are literally hundreds of names of important people who had information about various government crimes. And when you total them all up, you have a stockpile of corruption, the kind of a decaying civilization that Robinson Jeffers spoke of. But the important point he made, that I keep making, is that if you don't acknowledge that these things happen, if you turn the other way, if you don't add them up, if you don't see it, and you can't acknowledge it, then you can't make this earth survive, because it's on its way out, and you can't continue to live unless you acknowledge this part of your past. Speaking of acknowledging, I have had the book by Anthony Summers called Conspiracy, and a lot of people have asked me if I would talk about it or review the book when I get through with the series, a great part of the next few weeks on Ronald Reagan and Jimmy Carter. I will go into it. I think it's so disgusting. It's very difficult for me to read the book. I just look at the cover. I have a copy of it here for you, the cover of the book Conspiracy. This is how Anthony Summers begins it. "It is certainly possible that a renegade element in the U.S. intelligence manipulated Oswald. Whatever his role on November 22, 1963, that same element may have activated pawns in the anti-Castro movement and the mafia to murder the president." Now, just from that cover alone, he believes it's possible that a renegade element in the CIA or in the United States intelligence manipulated Oswald. You hardly would call Alan Dulles, the chief of the entire U.S. intelligence, the CIA, who formed from the OSS to the CIA, or John J. McCloy, or Lyndon Johnson, or Richard Russell from Georgia, or J. Edgar Hoover, or Richard Helms, as renegades. They were the establishment intelligence operatives. There wasn't anything renegade about the manipulation of Oswald. The second clarification he has on his cover, Oswald, whatever his role. If Oswald didn't kill anybody, it would be impossible to have an entire Warren Commission with 552 witnesses and thousands of pages and 26 volumes of documents and evidence and blame it on a renegade group of anti-Castro Cubans. You would have to control the testimony of every witness who came before the commission, which they did. You would have to have a staff of CIA attorneys interrogating them, which they did. You had CIA secretaries transcribing the notes, which they did. And all the top government officials, from the chief historian of the Pentagon on down, were involved. There was no renegade group. And whatever his role should be clarified before you decide who did it. If Oswald didn't own the rifle, never saw the rifle, there's no physical proof he had it, then how could you possibly have a renegade element handling this assassination? And as far as pawns, he says there are pawns in the anti-Castro movement and the mafia to murder the president. The anti-Castro movement was the Central Intelligence Agency, and the mafia was the Central Intelligence Agency. Holly renegades. In the book, before he begins his story, which we will share and analyze together, he begins by acknowledging Mary Farrell of Texas and Paul Hawk of California for his work. Paul Hawk, last I heard him, worked in the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory for the federal government, the Defense Department, and Mary Farrell works with the highest echelons of intelligence agencies, with Bernard Fensterwald, Gordon Novell, the CIA, the Defense Department. When I was in Texas, Penn Jones said, "Don't visit Mary Farrell." He suggested she was an agent at the time, even though he uses some of her material and indexing for his newsletters. And then he thanked Sylvia Marr, who also wrote an index of a subject index of the Warren Commission and left out all the Nazi connections, the Young Americans for Freedom, the Watergate connections that later showed up, the Douglas Caddy or Buckley. She left out of her bibliography and dictionary reference book on the assassinations all the names of the people that worked with General Walker that came to Germany, that worked with the Hunt brothers and the Nazis, the Birch Society in New Orleans and in Texas, particularly Dallas-Fort Worth connections. The subject index that Sylvia Marr made, and I have done radio shows a long time ago, left out all of those important names, Volkmar Schmidt, Larry Schmidt, the people that were involved in the real hard work of the assassination were deleted from her book. And then he thanks Bernard Fensterwald, who has worked with the CIA all of his life and was James McCord's attorney at the time of Watergate. And Jeff Goldberg, she thanked, he thanked, this is Summers thanking Jeff Goldberg of the AIB, that has now been recognized for what it is, a cover-up group, a renegade group itself of the intelligence community. And Jones Harris, who has always been a great admirer of J. Edgar Hoover, went into assassination work to defend the name of J. Edgar Hoover, his buddy, that's Jones Harris. So the people, she gives a few other people credit, I think of Sylvia Marr, it's actually, I'm talking about Anthony Summers now, gives Dr. Vincent Grin appreciation for his help and indebted to him for the ballistic evidence. It was in the hearings of the House Select Committee that Dr. Grin used different bullet fragments for the testimony in 1978 than were used at the time of the assassination when the Warren Commission did their work in 1964. They were different weights, different sizes. They were talking about different bullets. So I will go at length into the story of conspiracy by Anthony Summers, but again, it goes back to what Robinson Jeffers talked about. If you don't acknowledge or know that these things are wrong and fake, that they are disinformation, they are historically inaccurate, they're covering up the real criminals, then you are bound to doom this situation in this country and let these people take over, and it will be very hard to survive on their terms. I do want to reiterate in the narcotic connections that the Kennedy assassination, as far as I'm concerned, November 22nd, 1963, was the most important date in American history for two particular reasons. I've said them before, and I want to go into them again. When John Kennedy was murdered, it wasn't the first political assassination in the United States. It wasn't the first assassination in public or involved public leaders. It wasn't the first political assassination that was covered up. But it was the first murder of an elected president where every branch of the federal, state, local government was involved and could be proven to be involved. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, the President of the United States, the new president, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Department and the Pentagon, Navy Intelligence, Army Intelligence, the Internal Revenue, the entire justice system, the prosecuting attorneys, the people that could have been prosecuted that weren't, the staff of lawyers on the Warren Commission, past president of the Bar Association like Leon Jaworski, every high echelon official could be proven to have either perjured himself or knowingly covered up the crime and been held and could be held today for this crime. Every institution of public trust that should have been trusted, these various agencies, was involved in the cover-up, if not involved in the actual murder, was involved in the cover-up. And the situation that made it so important was that this was the most obvious and first public use of the combination of the intelligence community with organized crime. This was the marriage of the mobsters killing the President of the United States set up ever since, or as early as 1936, after Hitler was in power, organized crime in this country that is extremely right-wing and conservative began to take hold and got stronger and stronger. And after Tom Dewey prosecuted Lucky Luciano in New York City, and then he went on to Italy. He was incorporated in the OSS, and as soon as the war was over, members of organized crime were working during the war at shipyards, and then they went into the munitions industries. They supplied the vending machines for the army bases. They supplied materials for military installations today. And the organized crime dope dealers, the syndicate, the mob, the hitmen, the forgers, the swindlers, the chairman of brothels, the blackmailers, the dope dealers of all kinds, incorporated with the United States federal agencies and got so tangled that whether you call it the mob, the syndicate, the Cosa Nostra, whatever you want to call it, they got so entangled both into the military and into the political network of this country. They used each other. They had a common denominator, which was the Soviet Union. They had a common purpose of wiping out the opponents for the politicians or the witnesses to the trial or the witnesses to the Kennedy assassination or other assassinations. So they had a good thing going. One was allowed not to be prosecuted for drugs, prostitution, and various crimes that the syndicate does in exchange for being hitmen for the official politicians. And this statement can be proven over and over again in book after book that I have collected or which is available now that I haven't yet purchased. So that while the election year is going on at this time between Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, there is more to whether they have the seat in the White House to run specific corporations or foreign policies. What is determined in the White House is that each of these men has a different turf, and they're protecting that geographic turf for the narcotic connections. And this is the reason there's so many narcotic deaths recently. It's the reason there's so many arrests recently and so many names linked to mob figures recently, because they're trying to bring each other down without the other one retaliating on them too hard. Now, just in brief generalities, if I break down the A team and the B team according to the politicians and then use some newspaper articles to cite what I mean, it might be a little clearer. These are just generalities, and they overlap, but they do have specific effects that can be proven in the daily news if you see it and read it carefully. One team, the A team, I call the West Coast team. It began with the aerospace industry, the building up of Lockheed, the use of, as I say, Murray Chotiner with Earl Warren and Richard Nixon's career. And this team has worked in Southeast Asia with Alan Dulles. They brought in from the Golden Triangle, or that triangle down there, cocaine, heroin, and so forth, out of Thailand, out of Vietnam, and Southeast Asia. Alan Dulles was behind those operations. The Shah of Iran's sister was a dope dealer. The Shah was involved. The head of many governments got the spinoff and the profits from the narcotics traffic, and it was very lucrative for them, for their gunmen, to be reaping in millions for the narcotics traffic. And this, most of this narcotics from Southeast Asia was processed in Marseille, the Marseille connections, which just recently have combined with the Middle East connections in order to survive. In simplistic terms, this team has been close to Pepsi-Cola, where the Jimmy Carter Southern connections are to the Coca-Cola. At one time when Carter was in, they said the Coca-Cola team's in now instead of the Pepsi-Cola team. That's just a simplistic explanation. But one area of narcotic traffic that came in the corpses of GIs from Vietnam and Air America and the Flying Tigers and so forth, the Middle East narcotics was not big until the Shah was out. The Shah could keep a lid on the Middle East narcotics, and the Southeast Asian narcotic was linked heavily to the politicians in California, up and down California, and Nevada and Arizona and that element. They had their strong connections in that Team A. Now, I'm going to take a break while we turn the cassette over. It is 30 minutes. Now, I'll go back to the Team B, the Carter connections in Georgia, and try to explain the drug war that's going on between these two teams at this time.